Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Jerry Schwarzbach today, a famous author, defense attorney, recently elected as a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow, the author of Leaning on the Ark. He's represented very many famous defendants over the years, and he has really interesting observations about what that means for our criminal justice system. Jerry.
Thanks, George. And thank you all for coming. When I talk to prospective clients, I tell them before they decide whether they want to retain me, is that I don't promise any results, but I do promise I will not lie to them. I also tell them if they retain me that I'm going to tell them what I think as opposed to what I think they want to hear, because those are not always the same thing. And I'm going to do both of those things tonight. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, since 1989, 1,780 people, approximately, who were wrongly convicted have been exonerated. 156 of them from death row. Lord knows how many people were wrongly convicted and never exonerated. Lord knows how many people were wrongly convicted and executed. The consequences of wrongful convictions are, of course, that lives are devastated. The people who were wrongly convicted and those of everyone who loves them. Something that gets lost in that discussion is that whenever someone is wrongfully convicted, that means the real perpetrator is actually still out on the street able to victimize people. So it seems to me that there are certain questions that cry out, which is, why does this happen? How does this happen? And what can be done to prevent these injustices? I have written a book, Leaning on the Ark, A Personal History of Criminal Defense. The title of the book comes from part of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, in which he said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And so my book, my hope is that my book makes a positive contribution to an understanding of the criminal justice system, which I think very few people understand. You know, including in my law school days, many of which were spent in public housing projects in Washington, D.C., I've spent almost 50 years working and living in the criminal justice system in this country. And it's been patently obvious for all that time that there are inherent flaws in the criminal justice system. People in this country are supposed to be presumed innocent. It's a fiction. It's a complete fiction. And lawyers have to struggle heartily in court to make it a reality in any trial. One example, I'll give you a woman came into my office a few years ago. She was writing a piece about me for, I don't recall, a magazine or a newspaper. And she walked in my office and she started praising me about my representation of the actor Robert Blake, who I represented in his Los Angeles murder trial, and who was acquitted. And she's going on and on about how great I was in Robert's case. And I finally said to her, well, how much do you know about the evidence in Robert's case? And she said, well, nothing really other than he was guilty. And something that I added to this talk yesterday is I went to the gym to work out, which obviously it's apparent I work out. And a fellow came up to me and said, "I saw you on TV this morning." I said, "Really? What was that about?" Well, yesterday was the 15th anniversary of the murder of Robert Blake's wife. And on the Today Show, NBC's Today Show, they had a piece about that. And they interviewed the lead detective in the case, who said he was convinced that Robert had murdered his wife. And they interviewed, quote, Robert's PI, who said that he believed Robert did not murder his wife, but that he had paid somebody to do it. They also had a former L.A. deputy district attorney on who said it's really hard to convict a celebrity. They just have an obvious benefit. NBC never contacted me for the piece. I'm holding up. The radio audience won't see. I'm holding up a 21-page complaint that I filed with the Los Angeles Police Department after Robert's trial because of the multiple instances of misconduct by the lead detective who NBC put on TV, who had suppressed evidence of suppressed exculpatory evidence, had suppressed evidence that critical prosecution witnesses had serious substance abuse issues and were mentally ill, and including hallucinations. He actually had admitted one of them to the hospital, didn't prepare a police report about it. Former prosecutor who they had on TV wasn't involved in the prosecution of the case. And I can tell you, we had juror questionnaires, and approximately 80% of prospective jurors believed Robert was guilty. And the, quote, Robert's PI, who opined that Robert had paid the murderer, I tried the case. The guy didn't work for me. He worked for one of my predecessors on the case. And when I got in the case, there was an enormous amount that had to be done. And that PI was not privy because he hadn't discovered all the evidence the investigators who I hired did discover. He didn't know about the subpoenas that we had served where we obtained critical medical records. He didn't know the witnesses who we found that he hadn't found. But he was on national television saying that Robert Blake had hired the murderer. It was obviously completely irresponsible journalism by NBC, and I attempted to reach them yesterday to complain about it. But it's another example that the presumption of innocence is indeed a fiction, even if you're acquitted. And being a celebrity is not an advantage. A lot of people, there is a relationship, I think, to some extent, between O.J. Simpson's case and Robert Blake's case. And a lot of people make it, but they make it in the wrong way. They make the connection in the wrong way. In both cases, the defendant was acquitted of murder, but was found responsible in a civil case. I can't speak to either the criminal or civil Simpson cases, but I can speak quite definitively to both the criminal and civil cases in Robert's case. I didn't try the civil case because his original lawyers in that case had completely mishandled the case. It was set for trial just a couple months after we finished the criminal case. I had lived in L.A. for over a year. I was being treated for exhaustion. There was no way I could try the case. The civil trial was more of a circus than it was a serious legal proceeding. It was a completely flawed verdict. There were serious errors by the trial judge. There was obvious juror misconduct. And the appeal was denied, I believe, because of the O.J. Simpson case, which is one of the things the jurors in that case, in the civil case, were talking about, which they shouldn't have been talking about. But a connection between the Simpson case, the real connection between the Simpson case and Robert's case, is the only reason, in my judgment, the only reason Robert was prosecuted. is because the L.A. District Attorney's Office and the L.A. Police Department wanted to make up what was perceived for their bungling of the O.J. Simpson case. And they wanted Robert's scalp. And they would do anything to get it, including suppressing evidence and just a number of outrageous things. But of course, the way our criminal justice system works, the prosecutor, who I believe was at least partially responsible, if not more, for misconduct that occurred in that case, is no longer a prosecutor. You'll be happy to hear that. She's now a judge. The fact of the matter is, we proved that Robert was innocent. They couldn't, after a year of investigating, they couldn't come up with a single credible witness that he had actually tried to get them to murder his wife. And they never came up with anybody who they can say Robert had any connection with who actually committed the murder. So then they adopted the theory that he did the murder. Well, they found the murder weapon. I won't go into the detailed story of how they completely bungled the forensic examination of that, which perhaps which cost the opportunity to get any fingerprints off of the murder weapon. But in any case, they found the murder weapon. As of the time I got in the case, the weapon had never been test-fired by the defense. Didn't understand why, but it hadn't been. It was a World War II German gun. And I really only learn stuff, scientific stuff, when I'm doing cases, and then it sort of goes out of my head. But the basic principle that is important in this case is when the gun was discharged, it would spew out gunshot ready residue, particles of burnt gunpowder. And they can be categorized in two ways. They can be either, to be the actual gunshot residue, they have to have three particular elements, chemical elements. If a particle has less than three, then it's consistent with gunshot residue, but it could be any one of a variety of things. When we test fired, Robert's wife was shot twice in the head. When we test fired the weapon, it produced 2,440 particles of gunshot residue on the hands, of particles that were consistent with being gunshot residue, but some may or may not have been gunshot residue, on the hands of the person who fired the weapon. They had tested Robert's hands the night of the murder. He had five particles that were consistent with, but not necessarily, gunshot residue on his hands. There were 500, when we test fired the weapon, there were 537 particles that absolutely were gunshot residue on the hands of the person who fired the weapon. Robert had none. Zero. He didn't commit the murder. Yet, he's still presumed guilty. You know, aside from the presumption of guilt, which is actually simply a natural tendency, frankly, probably all of us, when we pick up a newspaper or we go online or radio or TV and hear about somebody getting arrested for something, I mean, you know, what's your first reaction? Oh, it's so unfair that they busted that poor innocent. We all presume people guilty. It's just human nature, but something that you have to fight against. And that's why law is important. Law plays a critical role in a civilized society, and when, if you're not faithful to the law, if it's a fair law, if you're not faithful to your ethical obligations, you're not going to have a functioning criminal justice system. You know, there's been a national political agenda for many years that undermines the criminal justice system. In order to get elected, politicians of both parties will play upon people's understandable fear of crime, their lack of knowledge of the sources of crime, bigotry and prejudice based upon color of people's skin or their ethnicity, or these days their religious beliefs. And these politicians get elected, and then they enact legislation that makes more conduct criminal, that increases the penalty and prison sentences if people are convicted. Yet they do virtually nothing to address the sources of crime. Prison populations have grown completely out of control, while the crime rate has remained relatively stable for many years. And no political party has a monopoly on this kind of behavior. Bill Clinton is responsible for mass incarcerations based upon legislation he signed in 1994. Also in 1996, he signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which completely undermines the federal habeas corpus proceedings and creates all kinds of procedural barriers to people getting habeas corpus relief in federal court. And there's virtually no rehabilitation in prison. And so when people do get out of prison and they return to society, they don't have skills with which to work and make a living, and they may well be more dangerous than they were when they went in. There appears to be, in this presidential election year, a belated recognition by some politicians that the criminal justice system is broken. I've known that for 50 years. You know, in some respects, the system has gotten better, but in many ways, it remains the same or has gotten significantly worse. Leaning on the Ark is in part a memoir. I didn't intend it to be a memoir. I wanted to educate people about the criminal justice system and its failings and the critical role that criminal defense lawyers play in an effort to make the Constitution work for everybody so that actually the result is justice. But it took me a long time to get a literary agent. And when I did, and I told her what I wanted to write about, she said, "Well, that's interesting. Nobody's going to publish that. Robert Blake's got to be in the book to get it published. And it's got to be a memoir, and you'll have to discuss other cases." So memoir became the vehicle by which I have attempted to achieve my original goal. I tell the true stories of 12 cases that I handled over the years. I also talk about where my moral foundation came from and why it was I became a criminal defense lawyer. My greatest criticism of the criminal justice system is what I perceive to be its tendency to objectify human beings. In my judgment, it undermines the entire legal process, and it is shared by virtually all criminal defendants, whether rich or poor, whether famous or not. You see, because it's easier to throw out an inanimate object. It's easier to throw out trash than it is to incarcerate or actually execute a human being who has a life story, who has people who he or she loves and who love him or her. If people really want to fight crime, it requires an honest analysis of who the people are who commit crime and what were the conditions that in their lives that led them to engage in criminal conduct. What such an analysis will reveal is that a great deal of crime is committed as a result of poverty, discrimination, mental illness, substance abuse, sexual abuse, child abuse, domestic violence, lack of positive role models, hopelessness for any kind of future. Because if you don't have any hope for a future, what do you have to lose? And many, many people are socialized to hate other people. If you want to fight crime, you have to address those underlying conditions. In my view, people are sort of like houses. you don't build a house from the roof down. And like houses, if people don't have a solid foundation, you're going to have problems in the future. But like houses, people can be rehabilitated. And good people sometimes do terrible things under extraordinary circumstances. So we ought not only focus on the crime. You can't ignore the crime, of course, but you have to look at who the person is. And although somebody may be, quote, terrible at some point in their life, it doesn't mean that they have to remain, quote, terrible for the rest of their lives. We give up on people too easily. It is possible to redeem people. I've seen it. I'm going to talk a little bit about it with you. But it's not possible if you don't try. And as a society, we don't make enough of an effort to do that. If you view human beings as objects, you will never understand what influenced them to engage in criminal conduct. If you view people as objects, you will never be able to help them to turn their lives around, to address the fundamental issues that they had to address in their lives that caused them to make mistakes. And if you see people as objects, as a society, we will never address the underlying causes of crime. If someone has actually done something that merits the intention of the criminal justice system, their criminal case is a problem, but it is virtually always a symptom of underlying issues. And when I have a client, like any criminal defense lawyer, my principal responsibility is to get the best legal result I possibly can for my client. And that's what I have tried to do for 46 years. However, what I also always try to do is I try to help my clients identify the reasons they committed crime, what issues they have in their lives, whether it's substance abuse or whether it was something from their childhood, whatever it might be. And obviously, I don't have the expertise to help all of them, so I try to direct them to people who might be able to help them. Unless it's like a murder case where someone's looking at life, I'll tell my clients, look, I don't care how badly this thing goes, you're going to get through it. But you need to be asking yourself, who are you going to be when you get through it? What will you have learned by this experience? What life lessons will you have learned? What skills will you have to have a positive, productive, happy life? A lot of people who have been harmed, whether physically or emotionally, as children, they kind of create a protective layer over their emotional core, their psychological core. And with some people, that layer gets thicker over time, and with some people, it becomes a hard shell. They don't want to let anybody in because they've been hurt before, and it's hard for them to trust people. But it is possible to get there. It is possible. So I want to tell you a true story. I write about it. I'm only telling you a little bit about it. It's in Chapter 8 of Leaning on the Ark. In 1990, I was asked to accept an appointment under unusual circumstances in a capital murder case in Santa Clara County. There had been a double murder. Two fellows killed. A third survived with a bullet in his brain. This occurred in 1984. Four men were charged. When I got in the case, there was only one defendant left. His name was Murray Lodge. The prosecution was seeking death. Literally the first day that I became Murray's lawyer, I found out that one of the co-defendants who had gone to trial, been convicted, and was doing life without patrol, without parole, possibility of parole, had nothing to do with the crime. His name was Buddy, Buddy Nickerson. And Murray and Buddy had known each other before the day of this crime, and they hated each other for years. But Murray had said Buddy didn't have anything to do with it. Murray actually thought it was funny, Buddy got arrested. But he assumed the criminal justice system was going to work, and Buddy was going to get acquitted. But it didn't work. The surviving victim had identified Buddy as one of the perpetrators. He had, in notes that were not readily available to the defense, he had described the perpetrators as three white men of average build. And he testified that Buddy was one of those one of the perpetrators. A fellow who lived in the neighborhood, who saw somebody running, holding his midsection, running away from the crime scene, testified at Buddy's trial he was 100% sure Buddy was the guy he saw. And he had described to the responding officers this person he saw running. It's 5'11 to 6 feet, 190 to 200 pounds. So what's the problem? At the time of the crime, Buddy was about 5'11, 6 feet. But he weighed 425 pounds. I don't consider that average. I'm from a small town, Pennsylvania, but I didn't consider that average size. So what happened? What happened is what happens a lot, what happened in Robert's case, what happens in a lot of cases, is that rather than really conduct an investigation, if you're going to conduct an investigation, you just follow leads wherever they go. And then, you know, at the end of the investigation, you try to put the pieces together and see if you can reach a conclusion. You may or may not be able to. But what often happens, and what happened in Buddy's case, is they started with the conclusion that he was guilty, and they manipulated witnesses and evidence in order to get his conviction. But I decided that since the surviving victim had identified both Murray and Buddy, and I knew he was wrong about the guy who was 425 pounds, if I could prove Buddy's innocence, it might help Murray. So I decided to go to Tehachapi State Prison where Buddy was. And I went with my investigator. Her name was Kathy Kornblith. My name's Schwartzbeck. We're not Irish. So it wasn't a visiting day. We go in this large room. We're the only people in there other than the guards who are at some distance watching us, and Buddy comes out. And Buddy is one big, angry guy. He has no idea who's there to see him. He sits across the table from me, and he puts his fist underneath his chin with his large forearm facing me. His whole forearm was a swastika. Buddy was a racist and an anti-Semite. And for, I don't know whether it was 45 minutes or how long it was, I don't recall, he was pretty much a jerk. And I finally lost patience with him. I had explained to him why I was there. You know, I know you guys don't like each other, et cetera, but I think, you know, I don't know if this can help get you out, but it may. He was hearing none of it. So I finally said to him, look, man, if you want, I'll leave. And if I leave, I can't make you one promise. Oh, yeah, what's that? I said, I promise you that if I leave now, so does your last chance of ever leaving this place in anything but a box. Pregnant pause. I hear him, you know, I could see him, Jewish, shmooish, I might be able to get over this. He chills out. We end up having a productive conversation, and he agrees to cooperate. And Kathy and I got up to leave. And then when I got up to leave, I said, oh, by the way, you know, if I ever do anything that helps to get you out, you got to do something about that swastika. And then we left. Now, my co-counsel and I represented Murray for 5 years. There were two trials. Oh, I didn't tell you that in the first of Murray's trials, we came across towards the after in trial for about 10 months or so. We totally by accident came across this recording the detectives thought that they had erased that proved that they had suppressed evidence and committed perjury. It wasn't a matter of he said, she said, it was right on tape. So this judge, after being in trial for a very long time, had no alternative but to declare a mistrial. I proposed just issue an order that they can't get the death penalty and we can go forward. Anyway, it's a mistrial. Were those detectives prosecuted? Of course not. The Attorney General's office didn't prosecute them. Oh, but something did happen to them. They were promoted from sergeants to lieutenants and from lieutenants to captain. One of them ran for sheriff, fortunately lost, and the other one, I'm told, was put in charge of training after a judge had found that he had suppressed evidence and committed perjury. So anyway, after representing Murray for 5 years through two trials, we were able to save his life. And then Murray and Buddy waived conflict of interest, and Ed, Susan, and I began to represent Murray for free. Then people would say, you know, why are you going to do that? Why are you racist, anti-Semite? Didn't matter to me. I had much more experience than Ed. I was the only person on the face of the earth who could undo this wrong or try to. How do you not? Because criminal defendants aren't objects. They're people. And we become lawyers, hopefully, to achieve justice. And it doesn't matter what someone's skin color is or what their beliefs are. You know, it wasn't right. We filed petitions in state court, Superior Court, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, all denied without a hearing. We filed a federal habeas corpus petition in San Francisco, and we were very fortunate to have the case assigned to the Honorable Marilyn Hall Patel. And during the course of that litigation, the Attorney General's office was arguing that factual innocence is not a basis for habeas corpus relief. And that was not an unusual argument for the Attorney General to make, because as now the late Justice Antonin Scalia wrote in a dissent in a capital case, this court, quote, this court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial, but is later able to convince a habeas corpus court that he is actually innocent. Sorry, dude. Life's a bitch. But you had a fair trial, and that's really the important thing, right? Not whether you're guilty or innocent. Eventually, in 2003, Judge Patel wrote a very lengthy opinion in which she reversed Buddy Nickerson's conviction, and he was released. About a year before she did that, Buddy wrote me a letter from prison. It actually hangs on the wall in my office. He's, you know, thanking me for this and that and saying all kinds of nice things. Crudely written, but this is part of what he wrote. You made me see people for who they are and not what they are. And I'll get the tattoo removed, like I said, because I know of no other way to show you that I have very high regard for you and your family. Don't write people off. Buddy got out. He got every racist and anti-Semitic tattoo removed from his body. Did it with anesthesia because he thought he deserved to experience pain for having been that kind of person. The death penalty, in my view, is another example of subjectifying human beings. And it's always interesting to me. I don't find it interesting. I actually find it outrageous, and it just makes my blood boil, that prosecutors, when seeking death, they don't care about what happened to this adult when the adult was a child. They don't care about the child abuse. They don't care about the domestic violence. They don't care about any of the, they don't care about mental illness. They don't care about anything. They just want death. In my judgment, the death penalty is going to end. Hopefully it'll end in California this year, in this state. If it does end, it won't end for the right reasons. It's inhumane. The state ought not be teaching people not to kill by killing. It'll end because of financial reasons. It will end because the system is broken, because it costs too much. There are people sitting on death row for years waiting to just get a lawyer appointed to represent them, because handling a capital case, whether at the trial level or appellate level, is very, very difficult stuff. I mean, you literally, someone, whether someone lives or dies, is in part dependent upon what you do or don't do and how well you do it or don't do it. But hopefully it'll end. It's funny that because these prosecutors who would have prosecuted the people who perpetrated the brutality on these adults when they were children, if they had intervened when they were children, but society didn't intervene at that time, they don't care. They don't have a life history. All they have is a crime that they committed. We just look at the surface. We don't want to look behind it. And if we don't look behind it, you'll never see a human being. I want to tell you just briefly about another person who I represent in a death penalty case. He was charged with murder, prosecution seeking death. He's a white guy, and he had this large tattoo that went across the front of his head, and it said white power. So obviously we know everything we need to know about this guy, right? He's this white, racist jerk. I twice turned down, they were having trouble finding somebody to represent him. I twice turned it down. I had done capital cases. It takes an enormous toll on the lawyer. Had taken an enormous toll on me, had taken an enormous toll on my family. My wife and son have suffered immeasurably for my career. They weren't anxious for me to do it. I wasn't anxious to do it. But finally, third time I was asked, I said, I'll go talk to the guy. So I went to San Quentin, and I meet this guy, and I said, I point to his forehead, and I said, I can read. I'm Jewish. We got a problem? He said no. And I had a precondition to agreeing to represent him, and that was if I was able to get the prosecution to offer life without the possibility of parole, he would accept it. There wasn't any question of his guilt. He was a San Quentin inmate, had killed someone. He had killed another inmate in the yard. The other inmate had been convicted of murder for having run over a 9-year-old girl and taking off her father's legs. And inmates have a code, too. You don't victimize children. It's one of them. And if you do, you're a target. And when that fellow was, when his case was pending in the Superior Court, he was kept in isolation to keep other inmates from getting to him. When he got to San Quentin, they put him out in general population, and I believe they did it knowing what the results would be. First day out, he was dead. And as I took my client off the yard, he said, all I got to say is 9-year-old girl. So there wasn't any question about guilt. So I wanted, and I didn't want to try a capital murder case unnecessarily, because the best we would ever do is life without. Anyway, he agreed. And we had a conversation, and then he asked me if I'd send him some books because he likes to read. So I said, sure, what would you like? And he starts telling me, like, well, he's like really horrible, gruesome, bloody, ugh, books. He said, nah, I don't think so. I said, how about some other books? He said, like what? I said, well, how about the autobiography of Malcolm X? Read it. He had read Obama's two books, too. He wasn't a racist at all. He had been already sentenced to over 50 years in prison. He got to prison in Tracy, knew he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison, figured he had to align in order to survive, and that's where he got the tattoo in prison. And that fellow, he actually never had a chance in life. When his mother was pregnant with him, she was smoking weed, taking cocaine, drinking alcohol. When he was born with a neurological deficit in the frontal lobe, which causes lack of impulse control. And at one point, months later, he said, I have trouble controlling my impulses. I said, really? His father was in prison. His mother had boyfriends who came in the house. There were drugs around all the time. There was domestic violence. He was beaten up a lot. He was frequently in custody as a child, and as an adult, he was an alcoholic, homeless man. He just never had a chance. He did get life without parole. He had killed this other guy because he had been ordered by somebody in the gang, prison gang, to do it. He's no longer in a prison gang because that's never who he was. And he's risked his life to leave the gang. It's not like, the Elks. in my view, many Americans have forgotten that the Constitution exists to protect all of us. It was written because of a recognition that tyranny is an ever-present danger. And Americans, although they won't admit it, are no less vulnerable to tyrannical appeals than people in other countries. You can just think about some of the arguments that have been made in the current presidential campaign. And again, it's not a matter of political party necessarily. Rush Limbaugh, he didn't have much respect for the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution until he got busted and hired a lawyer who asserted his Fourth Amendment rights in order to avoid a conviction. And even recently, President Obama, who, I really supported, really believed in, I still support him. I don't believe he's fulfilled the promises, all the promises that he made, but he recently nominated Judge Merrick Garland for the U.S. Supreme Court to replace Scalia. And I recognize he wanted to put the Republicans between a rock and a hard spot on this nomination. So he nominates Judge Garland, who's viewed, everybody likes him, really, really bright, moderate, down the middle kind of guy. He actually is not very good on criminal defense rights. When President Obama was introducing Judge Garland to the country, he was saying all these glowing things about him, but something really caught my attention. Judge Garland had been with the Justice Department, had been in charge of the prosecution of Timothy McVeigh, who was responsible for the Oklahoma City bombings. And the president said that that Judge Garland, quote, did everything by the book. would take no chance that someone who murdered innocent Americans might go free on a technicality. Excuse me, Mr. President? On a technicality? What are you referring to? Oh, a constitutional right? You know, the president could have said Judge Garland was so careful to protect the constitutional rights of even the most unpopular person in the country. But he chose to say technicality. It's not helpful. There are many who are faithful to their assigned roles in the criminal justice system and the Constitution. However, the system fails when they're not. When law enforcement officers are either lazy, incompetent, or really not interested in the truth, if prosecutors are just interested in convictions and not justice, and judges whose priority is moving cases along, and some of whom have a pro-prosecution bias because there's an enormous plurality of judges who are former prosecutors, or if they're defense attorneys who haven't cared enough to work hard enough for their clients. When judges, law enforcement officers, and prosecutors fail to honor their ethical obligations, innocent people can be and have been convicted. When criminal defense lawyers fail to fulfill their ethical obligations, innocent people can be and have been wrongfully convicted. Criminal defense lawyers, it's known, are not viewed favorably by the overwhelming majority of people in this country. And I address that up front, very first chapter of my book. But criminal defense lawyers care just as much about crime as do prosecutors and judges. I became a criminal defense lawyer because of what I saw when, as a law student, I worked in the public housing projects in Washington, D.C., and I saw how the economic and legal systems were rigged against the poor and people of color. I saw that poverty, discrimination, mental illness, and substance use and child abuse existed. And I saw the obvious relationship between those things and the commission of crime. And I believed that being a criminal defense lawyer was a vehicle by which I could do something meaningful with my life because those folks needed people to fight for them, even if they make mistakes. Maybe most importantly, when they make mistakes. You know, sometimes because I've been in cases that have gotten some publicity, I'll be asked, are you working on an important case? Every case is important to me. Every case is important to the client who I'm representing, and it's important to me. I don't distinguish between a misdemeanor client and a murder client. For many years, I primarily represented poor people as a court-appointed lawyer here in San Francisco. And I remember one time taking in a fee petition to a judge at the conclusion of the case. And he was going to determine, you know, we're paid a certain pittance per hour. And the judge looks over my fee petition and he said, Jerry, you put too much time into this case. And I said to him, Judge, I don't think you'd feel that way if you were my client. You know, we're outraged as a society by street crime. We're not similarly outraged by corporate crime. Who are the most cold-blooded, premeditated murderers that I can think of? How about the people who manufactured cigarettes, knowing that they were going to kill people? I was involved in a civil case against a car manufacturer, and we argued, and the jury believed that they manufactured an SUV knowing it was going to kill people. And they advertised, they knew it was going to roll. And they had designed it to have a roll bar. And they decided to take the roll bar out, but they left the design in so it looked like it had a roll bar. And they had these television commercials which showed it as a wonderful family vehicle. And they showed the kids sitting in the back seat, which happened to be the most dangerous place to be in the vehicle. That is the most cold-blooded, premeditated murder case I've ever been involved in. Because the people responsible for that, what they did is, and we proved it, they tried to figure, they knew they were going to kill people and injure people, and they figured how many lawsuits, what are we likely to have to pay, versus how much market share are we going to lose if we make it safer? And they made that cold-blooded decision to put this unsafe vehicle out there and increase their market share. And those people, they didn't suffer from substance abuse, child abuse, all those other things I was talking about it. They went to their churches and synagogues or whatever. They participated in Little League and whatever. Cold-blooded murderers. And it seems to me they had to objectify human beings. Because how could you do that? How could you, I mean, how could you think of somebody out there, a consumer, as someone like your wife, your husband, your child, your grandchild? How could you, wouldn't do that. So you have to objectify a human being to do that. The best advice I think I ever received about being a lawyer, I didn't receive from a lawyer. I received from my grandfather. He was 91 years old at the time. You're going to be a lawyer? You be a good lawyer. You be an honest lawyer. You be somebody people can trust. Better advice than I ever got in law school. Being a dedicated criminal defense lawyer is very hard work. And as I said, it takes a toll on the lawyer and on the lawyer's family. And the greatest challenge for me is to be the best lawyer I could possibly be while simultaneously being the best husband and father I can be. Robert Blake, in a press conference immediately after his acquittal, said something of me that applies to virtually all dedicated criminal defense lawyers. Robert said, quote, "He will never be rich and he will never be famous. But by God, he can save lives. And that will keep him warm on any cold night in his life." And folks, it has. Thank you.
To Jerry Schwartzbeck speaking about his book, Leaning on the Ark, his personal history of his life in criminal defense. And we have time for just a couple of questions, but we'll get started. Thank you.
Sure. Hi, Jerry. It's Bill Balin. Really glad to hear you. Would you talk a bit about the interplay between the mental health system and the criminal justice system and the problems that a person who is not facing a life penalty would have if that person has a possible mental illness defense?
Well, one of the areas in which there has been improvement, and you have to understand, there are different legal systems all over the world. And California, though it's got a quite flawed system, has made strides, and that's an area in which we have made strides. We now have mental health courts. And we have drug courts. And so if it's been identified and the crime isn't too serious, that a person has mental illness, they can be referred to the mental health court. They have to go there. Usually it's once a week they have to be there. They're told they have to be in therapy. They have to provide proof they're going to therapy. It varies how long that period of time would be, but if they complete the program, their case can be dismissed. There's also a drug court that has a similar kind of program. I doubt that such programs exist in states in the Deep South. But that's an area, I suspect in many states there are no such programs. and that very little attention is given to a person's mental illness.
Next question.
It sounds like you're against the death penalty.
Who, me?
Yeah. And I understand from what I've read, there's no evidence that the death penalty is any kind of prevention against people committing crimes. Isn't that true?
Well, I can just tell you. I mean, I've represented a number of people accused of murder, some of whom who actually committed the murder. None of them given a second to think about getting caught or what the penalty might be if they did get caught. And usually, or very frequently, they're high on some drug at the time that they commit the murder. It has absolutely no deterrent effect. Anyone who's really involved, criminal defense lawyers have an insight that really no one else in the criminal justice system has, because you get to know your client. And in my experience, it has absolutely no deterrent effect whatsoever. It's simply vengeance.
Okay, given all that, I guess it's vengeance. It seems to me like there are crimes committed by people, the really bad crimes where children are killed indiscriminately, or that a person that does that doesn't have anything to contribute to society at all. And there has to be, it seems to me like there just has to be some kind of sentence against this person worse than sitting in a jail the rest of his life.
I don't know if you've had the opportunity to be in any of the state prisons in California. If you've ever been in a secure housing unit, what they call a SHU unit, where people can be locked up for 23 hours a day, they get out for an hour, and they have no contact with another human being. Spending one's life, entire life, in prison is a very, very severe penalty to pay. And again, if you focus, there are crimes that are outrageous. You know, if someone, you know, harmed my wife or my son, I'd want to go after them, okay? But that's emotion talking. The state ought not be, in my view, the state ought not be in the business of killing people. And as horrible as the crime might be, unless you know who the person is, you actually don't know whether or not they can contribute to society, even if it's in prison, even if it's in Murray Lodge, for example, doing life without parole. He's helped innumerable other inmates. And you know, Murray actually testified on Buddy's behalf, put his life at risk, testified at a federal habeas corpus evidentiary hearing. He was the only witness, didn't come to San Francisco because he was deemed too dangerous to be brought here. We had to go to the prison where he was housed. And at one point, I was saying, why should Judge Patel believe you? He said, look, I've done terrible things. I deserve to die in prison for the things that I've done. And he had done a lot of bad things. But he said, I don't like Buddy, but it ain't right. It ain't fair. Now, if someone only looked at what Murray had done, his criminal conduct, there were 43 incidents of aggravation at the penalty phase in his case. We started the penalty phase with 41, but he committed two assaults at lunch breaks while we were in trial. He risked his own life to help a guy who he didn't like because it ain't right. So unless you know the person, as horrible as the crime might be, don't know that that person has nothing to contribute, because he very well might, and if he doesn't, a lifetime in prison is really a horrible life.
make a great distinction at the beginning of your answer there between your own emotions about what would happen to your family and what the state should do. And I think it's a good idea to go back. Why did the criminal justice system get started, and why did law take the place? It took the place of personal revenge, which was devastating every society a couple thousand years ago, that people would always take out their revenge on the other person. There was no way to have a stable society.
Well, you know, in the United States, you know, most countries, the death penalty doesn't exist in most places around. In older societies, that you know, it doesn't exist. Very few. In the places that where it exists are not places that we would be proud to be partners with.
Right. So it's time for one more question.
Jerry, hi, Josh Davis. What do you think about juveniles being tried for crimes in adult courts, and do you predict any changes in our law and laws in that regard?
Well, it obviously, you know, there has to be, for that to happen, there has to be a hearing, and usually it doesn't happen unless the crime is deemed quite serious. But again, I can't answer the question in the abstract, because I think you have to know the child. And you have to know, I think you have to make an assessment as to, even if this teenager is guilty of what he or she is charged with, you know, is there a chance to help this person? Or are we simply writing them off, treating them as an inanimate object, so we'll send them to the superior court where, you know, we can seek our revenge?
A great distinction to finalize that presentation on. Thank you so much, Jerry. That was
thank you.
A great presentation, not only your personal history, but you clearly demonstrated being emotionally honest in your lecture that you must have been doing with your defendants all these years. It's just a great presentation. And that ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much, Jerry. And Jerry's book is available in the lobby for sale. You do sign your books?
If people want
it. If you want the signature, you'll get one. Thank you very much.